Hey there, everybody. I mentioned in the last episode that I was recording that there was an essay titled Terraforming Ganymede, Science and Technology and Robert A. Heinlein's Farmer in the Sky in the back of the copy of that book that I had. So I reached out to the Heinlein Society, who I've interacted with before for my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, and asked them if they could point me in the direction of the author of that essay, and they came through for me. So I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Jim Woosley for a discussion today. So hi there, Jim.
Hello, how are you doing today, Seth?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem.
How about a quick introduction of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, I'll say I'm fairly known and fairly well known in some circles here in Southern fandom, although I've not been very active for 10 or 15 years. Got my start in science fiction in the golden age, the age of 12, as everyone everyone says. That's when I discovered Mr. Heinlein, as well as the E.E. Smith's Lensman novels.
Nice.
Started, yeah, I think the Half Space Suit with Travel, Will Travel, was one of my first Heinlein novels. And amusingly, in my high school library, I discovered Starman Jones and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Mm.
So that was very helpful. Anyhow, I'll say that that did inspire me to go into the sciences.
Okay.
I got a bachelor's degree in physics and astronomy at my local college, and then went to graduate school at Vanderbilt University in physics.
Cool.
Presently working in the aerospace industry in Huntsville, Alabama.
Nice. I mean, that makes you a good person to talk to about you know, a book that involves space travel.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that kind of your love of science fiction pushed you toward the sciences. I've always wondered if, is that a common thing? I mean, I'm in engineering, and I do feel like growing up admiring Mr. Scott on the original series of Star Trek and Spock, you know, the science officer, made me want to head that direction as well.
I think it's a very general phenomenon. Larry Niven said in The Return of William Proxmire that Proxmire found that most of, at least in the story, that Proxmire found that most of the scientists and engineers he ran into grew up reading Robert Heinlein's work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's true, that most of the people I work with at least know who Robert Heinlein is. I may not know some of the other authors, but they're familiar with Heinlein, and they've had a lot of exposure to science fiction, either in literature or in movies.
Right. How did it transpire that you wrote the essay and it became attached to the book?
Since I'm presently rereading some of Lois Bajold's novels, I would probably have to give her answer, nepotism of a sort. I've known Toni Weisskopf since, I think, her second convention. Mm. And, of course, I live in Huntsville, Alabama, where she grew up. And she had previously encountered me doing a piece of Heinlein fanfic in the local science fiction club fanzine. Actually, about 2003 or so, I had published an essay there making my estimate at updating the Pandora's Box predictions for the future from the Expanded Universe 1980 update until I wrote that in 2002, 2003. And Toni encountered it there, and she actually purchased rights to publish that essay on Bain's Bar in association with the release of Expanded Universe by Bain a few years later.
Hmm.
And that was, I guess, the start of our professional relationship as writer, even though I don't think it ever actually appeared. I did get the royalty payment for it.
Hmm.
But then she contacted me when they were republishing Farmer in the Sky and asked for an essay about what would be known now about terraforming Ganymede that Heinlein wouldn't have known about when he was writing the novel in 1954.
Right. Yeah. I do feel like there's it's easy to go back to earlier fiction and give it a hard time for not coming up with ideas that we might think of as obvious today that we've known for decades, but you know, maybe they didn't, where you have novels that have intercity rockets and teleportation, but no concept of wireless communication. And right. It's just, I mean, there's the blinders of the present, right?
Right. And yeah, that in fact, that's one of the factors I mentioned in the essay was that writing in 1954, Heinlein assumed that radio contact between the colony on Ganymede and Earth would be just very rare during conjunctions or other periods when they could actually get a relay through Mars rather than a direct connection.
Right.
And you know, here we are 70 years later almost, and we've had direct connection to several flybys, not mm-hmm. only to Jupiter, but also Saturn, and out past the boundary of the solar system, since we're still receiving occasional messages from the two Pioneer spacecraft, which have passed the heliopause.
Mm. Wow.
So the certainly communication is much better than Heinlein estimated.
Yeah. I mean, kind of moving into, I do want to talk about, actually, let's go here first. You know, when you approach science fiction, let me back up. So you said that science fiction kind of pushed you into the sciences, and there's sort of a natural progression of science fiction can push you into the sciences, and then it can really, the science itself can affect what your tastes in science fiction. And so you mentioned Bujold, who, you know, in her stuff, it's not exactly what you'd call hard science fiction, right? There's a right. science fictional setting, future setting kind of yeah. thing. Do you have strong preferences for harder science fiction or softer?
My taste really run pretty much the whole gambit. The Lensman novels were more of a formative influence on my professional interest
okay.
than the Heinlein novels, because Smith included a lot of science and engineering as it was actually happening in his books. Mm-hmm. And that I found that very inspiring. And I was pleased that later in their life, I got to spend a few years getting to know Myrna Smith Trestrail. Mm. Mostly through conventions, but also through correspondence. But I read Heinlein. On the other end, I'm also a tardy fan of Tolkien. Mm. In the middle, I've got my son is very much into video gaming and anime. Mm. I've never been much of a gamer. Just give me a computer solitaire and I'm happy. He started introducing me to a few of his favorite anime, and including Science Gate, which is a very interesting time travel anime. Hmm. And that led me to explore some topics on my own. And presently, I find myself particularly fascinated by the light novel series that they did one series of an anime that captured the first seven volumes. The series itself is 40 volumes now. Mm. It's oddly titled Invaders of the Rokujoma, which is literally translates into English as Invaders of the Efficiency Apartment. And the protagonist found a apartment that was selling for $50 a month because it was rumored to be haunted. Mm. And the night after he moved in, the ghost appears to him and tries to get him to get out because she has to keep the apartment to wait for her parents to come back and get her. Mm. Then a Sailor Moon type of magical girl crashes in through the window and says, "I'm here to protect you from the evil magic in the apartment." And then one of the rugs on the floor pops open and a woman crawls up from a tunnel and says, "Hi, I'm with people who now have moved underground, but we need to take over the apartment because this is where our ancestors' shrine was at. And we need to use that to make magical weaponry to take over the surface."
Wow.
And then on top of that, the next thing you know, a princess from an intergalactic empire located 10 million light years from Earth steps through a stargate into the apartment and says, "I'm here to demand your allegiance to prove my worthiness to be the next empress." And so that's got it. You've got that's got fantasy, science fiction, again, mm-hmm. light science fiction, but there's still a lot in there.
Yeah.
And conflict is all built in. And they describe it, I spend probably too much time on TV tropes, but the TV trope says that it starts as what you might call an affectionate parody of a harem anime, but all of these characters, they end up becoming allies and trying to solve each other's problems. And that carries it up through the 7 volumes that were adapted into the anime. And then without giving anything away, the next volume after that takes a sudden step that turns it from just, in my opinion, from just an ordinary story into a really extraordinary story. Mm. And it grows from there. And say, I'm also rereading Bejeweled, and I've reread Tolkien recently. John Ringo is into military science fiction. Jim Butcher into other fantasy. So I cover the whole gambit.
Nice. So like when you're approaching one of the things in science fiction, if a book tends toward the harder science fiction, it leaves itself vulnerable, of course, to, is it going to be completely, you know, scientifically accurate? There's nothing speculative in the, no faster than light travel. Time travel probably as well. Sometimes I guess you can verge on this is theoretically possible, you know, wormholes, other things.
Right.
Are there scientific inaccuracies in books or movies that really stick in your craw, or are you able to just sort of go with the flow?
I can suspend disbelief through a lot of stories where things seem to make sense, where things come together. Mm-hmm. I think again, this is going back a day. My first real experience of not being able to suspend disbelief anymore to the extent that I just completely dropped the series after that was the original $6 Million Man series. Mm. I mean, I was a regular watcher. Mm-hmm. And then there was an episode where they, for some reason, a rover that had landed on Venus had returned to Earth without explaining how it managed to get back from Venus surface, mm-hmm. back to Earth, or back to space, then fly back to Earth. But it made an uncontrolled landing and was, quote, roving around terrorizing the countryside. how it would terrorize the countryside, I don't know. And the finally defeated by Steve Austin's the character, mm-hmm. hooking a hoist to it in a helicopter, lifting it up to 1,500 feet where it exploded because the interior was pressurized to the surface pressure of Venus. And I said, how on Earth could it have gotten into space around Venus, back to Earth, back to the surface of the Earth, right. and then have to be lifted back up before that pressure would have destroyed it?
Yeah, you'd think it would have passed through some areas of lower pressure on the way.
Yes. So that was that. So most of the time, I don't have any trouble with suspension of disbelief if the story and the characterization is good. But if it's something that's really egregious, bad science and bad storytelling, mm-hmm. I definitely catch it and usually don't go back.
Yeah. For me, I think internal consistency is kind of the key where fine. If you want to set ground rules where there's wormhole nexus, you know, kind of things like in the Vorkosigan saga, right? They can travel between systems right. because they have wormholes. Fine. As long as you establish that, great. But if you're willy-nilly going to light speed and not dealing with any relativistic effects, then that's where I go, okay, that you could have done better there.
Right.
I do think of like the famous Star Wars, did the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. And that's the right. kind of one where I think you just needed to ask one nerd and you would have him go, well, no, parsec is a distance, not a time.
Yeah.
Though I do enjoy some of the novel kind of retroactive continuity that they've built around that less than 12 parsecs thing, which was just a flub on Lucas's part. And now in the expanded universe, they filled it back in to say, oh, no. The distance means that it had to be going a certain speed, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, really, that's why I ultimately didn't care much for the Kevin verse in Star Trek or after J.J. Abrams then went on to destroy Star Wars. He has an inveterate fondness for having his characters view with unaided eyes stuff that is happening in other solar systems.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He does not have a good sense on how large space is. He needs to read some Douglas Adams.
it's when Spock watched Vulcan being destroyed.
Right.
That was a twofer.
Right.
In his original Star Trek movie. Mm-hmm. First, because I've read a tremendous amount of the Star Trek added universe novels, and particularly several of the ones about Vulcan and the history of Vulcan. Mm-hmm. And so that bothered me that all of that work was just so blithely thrown away in canon.
Yeah.
But then secondly, the fact that Spock was, I think, 1,500 light years away.
Yeah.
And visually watching Vulcan being destroyed.
Right, right. And it looked larger than our moon. And he was supposed to be on Delta Vega, I think, at that point. So in a completely different system. And yeah.
Right.
I still love that movie, but it is not hard science fiction by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. Not even to the extent that Star Trek usually was. So.
Yeah.
And then, in The Force Awakens, there's the same thing where that whole system is destroyed and you can see it from this distant planet. I think, no,
right.
That's not the way space works.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I see in a lot of science fiction films is not dealing correctly with free fall and, you know, life aboard a spacecraft. Like you think of like a 2010, the sequel to 2001. On the ship in that movie, they're not constantly in free fall. They're just walking around like it's normal. And it's one of those things that I just kind of go, okay, fine. You didn't want to film all of this on the Vomit Comet, or, you know, the 80s were probably a little early for some of the wire work that they do today in order to simulate that kind of thing. But I don't know. It doesn't bother me too much.
But at the same time, that wire work was all developed in 1978 for the Chris Reeve Superman
movie. Yeah, yeah. So I do want to talk more about the essay from Farmer in the Sky and some of the specifics of that, because I do appreciate that, you know, you kind of start off the essay crediting Heinlein for getting things, you know, reasonably correct based on the understanding to that point. But I'm not sure how much people understand that our understanding of the Jovian system has increased since, you know, the early 50s when he's writing this novel. What did we know back when Heinlein was writing that?
Really, at the time, we didn't have much knowledge at all. At that time, only methane and ammonia had been positively identified as gases in the Jovian atmosphere. We now know that there's a considerable portion of hydrogen and helium and other gases as well.
Was that just limitations of spectroscopy and
limitation of spectroscopy at the time?
Okay.
Obviously that was before even Explorer 1, much less the probes that have actually gone through the Jovian system.
Right.
The surface of Ganymede was extrapolated from astronomical images to be probably something much less like the surface of the moon, but it's because of the tidal forces from around Jupiter, it's got large rifts and chasms in it, so it's not a very smooth continuous surface like on the moon. Mm-hmm. There are differences. The surface is probably a little less rocky and more solid water and ice and ammonia ice and such as that, instead of silicate rocks like on Earth.
Right.
But still, of course, we don't have any actual data from the surface. We haven't landed a probe on Ganymede yet.
I remember when the Galileo probes first went out, I remember reading about it in the newspaper and seeing that they were going to reach Jupiter in 1994 or something. And I thought, oh, that's impossibly far away. But it was only like 6 years at the time. But so I guess what we know of Ganymede now, everything that I've read a little bit about it, and it seems like if you were somehow able to bring the surface temperature up to livable human temperatures, you might just end up with a lot of mud. But I didn't know if you had more ideas. Is it even feasible to terraform Ganymede, assuming that you had the technology to do everything?
I think that, I mean, you would have to add a lot of energy to the system to do that.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noted was that even with the greenhouse effect, it would be hard to get the temperature up to much above minus 16 Fahrenheit, even with the greenhouse screen of some sort protecting the moon, which is what Heinlein assumed.
Right, the heat shield, yeah.
The heat shield. Yeah, just one of the big things is that Heinlein assumed total matter to energy conversion
as right.
the energy source for the terraforming, but it was used somewhat inconsistently in retrospect, looking through the story, because apparently, I guess that it was something that was originally developed that could only be used on terraforming scale. But they didn't, in the story, they didn't develop the technology to use it for spaceship propulsion.
Right.
Until just before the events of the story, even though the terraforming of Ganymede had been going on for some time.
Yeah.
So they did all of that with slower rockets before they finally got a total conversion rocket to use as a basis for the basis for traveling from Earth to Ganymede.
Yeah. One of the things the book mentions is the lower atmospheric pressure. They're able to make the atmosphere breathable, but I think the way he puts it is there's 4 pounds of oxygen, which I guess he means PSI.
Right.
But it's breathable, but maybe disconcerting to have that little actual air pressure.
Right. I mean, we ran, unfortunately, the destruction test of a 3 PSI oxygen atmosphere on Apollo 1.
That's
what the atmosphere was planned for the Apollo missions. And they were running on simulated mission atmosphere when the Apollo 1 fire occurred.
Wow.
And after that, they decided to use the mixed oxygen helium or oxygen nitrogen atmosphere to reduce the risk of fire.
Okay.
Certainly that's something that would have been possible to use, 3 PSI partial pressure of oxygen and add a little bit of nitrogen
right.
to it. Supposedly they were planning to do that, but had not yet done that at the time of the story.
Mm.
But that meant that any spark that was fired would light anything on the surface aflame.
Right. Okay.
Anything combustible. That would be a very unsafe atmosphere from that perspective, in addition to the disconcerting effects of living just on pure oxygen at low pressure.
Right. Well, and, one of the characters, the younger sister, Peggy, never really adjusts to the lower pressure. And I don't know if that's a realistic thing, if people would be sensitive to that kind of thing.
Certainly. I don't know what the exact partial pressure is, but people have noted that a lot of the inhabitants of the upper reaches of the Andes are very adapted to an atmosphere that very few people who grow up at nearer sea level can even adjust to.
Mm.
And there are people who get altitude sickness just in driving over the Colorado Rockies.
Wow.
So the altitude sickness is very real. And in fact, I think that ultimately contributed to why Mr. Heinlein and Mrs. Heinlein left Colorado Springs for Carmel, California.
Mm. I mean, I've definitely experienced the higher elevation, like when we traveled through the national parks in Utah and, Bryce Canyon. I think the visitor center is at something like 8,000 feet. It's one of those things where you hike down into the canyon and it's beautiful, but that hike out is no picnic.
I've never been to that altitude myself, but I've had friends who've lived in the area, and the first couple of times they drove over the Rockies, they had no problems. But then later they started developing severe problems with driving over the Rockies when they were coming into the area.
Interesting.
So it's not even something that necessarily happens immediately. It's something that can happen, get worse with repeated exposure to the higher altitudes.
Okay. One of the major plots here is there's a sort of a, what do they even call it? not a grand junction, when the moons all align, a resonance of them, right?
Yeah, a conjunction.
Conjunction, there we go. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And there's, of course, a moonquake that occurs there. And I know that something like Europa, you know, getting pulled on by Ganymede on one side and Io and Jupiter on the other side, definitely it shows some evidence of that causing some stress. And maybe is it Enceladus? There's another one that looks very volcanically active because of that kind of stuff. How much of that does Ganymede get?
Well, obviously in the real world, that's one of the things that contributes to the surface roughness.
Okay.
Tidal forces that occur in the gravitational forces, both during directly from Jupiter and also from the conjunctions with the other moons.
Hmm.
So the possibility of moonquakes of that type are very real.
Okay. I remember hearing one time that Jupiter emits more heat radiation than it receives from the sun. I don't remember where I read that, but I don't know if it's enough to, it's certainly not enough to make Ganymede livable.
No, it's not enough to raise the temperature that much. Jupiter is right at the lower limit of what would be called a brown dwarf, which generates enough heat to glow in the infrared.
Okay.
But still, you need to get, I think, 10 more, 10 Jupiter's mass is roughly the break even for something that will have some small level of self-sustained fusion to be able to continue producing small amounts of energy as an infrared peak star.
Right. I guess if you threw enough monoliths into it, it would...
Probably.
that's what happens in 2010.
And unfortunately, we can't consult Mr. Clark or Mr. Highland about that possibility.
No, unfortunately not. I was curious about some of the atmospheric dynamics of the heat trap going away. And then within hours, the temperature dropped severely. And I didn't know if that's the way it would work on a smaller body. I know on Earth there's some time that it takes, when we end up at the winter solstice, we don't usually get our coldest day on the 21st of December. We usually, it lags back into February, but it takes time to kind of work through the atmosphere, or at least that's my understanding of it. I could be completely off.
Yeah.
So did you find that the heat trap going away and it immediately being a dire circumstance, believable?
Well, it's different circumstances. There's much less thermal mass on Ganymede and much less surface water, which is part of what helps trap the heat and moderate the temperature on Earth.
Okay.
So I find losing heat that quickly very believable.
Okay.
With the loss of the peat shield or the atmospheric shield.
All right. Well, there it is. Yeah. I guess when I think about that, I grew up in Anchorage, and Anchorage in the winter is not usually as harsh as someplace like North Dakota because of its proximity to the water. And so it kind of has a moderating influence, where if you go into the interior of Alaska, Fairbanks, you get the extremes.
Right.
Let's see. The one thing that you noted in the essay that I had picked up on myself was, I don't think Heinlein had a really great idea of the harm of cosmic rays during space travel.
Right.
Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah. No one at the time really understood cosmic radiation as an issue. Mm. We didn't have, I mean, we were starting to have an understanding of the effects of cosmic ray because virtually all of early particle physics was observing the consequences of cosmic rays penetrating the atmosphere.
Mm.
But no one knew the effects in space. No one knew exactly what the levels were in space at the time, clearly, until we had instrumentation in space. No one knew anything about trapped radiation in the form of the Van Allen belts until Explorer 1 and Van Allen's instruments on there, which is why the Van Allen belts bear his name.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. People know that cosmic rays came from space, and he had the idea that let's put some sort of particle detector on the satellite and see what comes back. And so they measured cosmic radiation, and eventually when we get to higher altitudes, they measured the radiation from the Van Allen belts.
Hmm.
So, cool. So it's there was a lot of learning there. And of course, Jupiter, because of its larger size and much larger magnetic fields, traps correspondingly much larger quantities of radiation in its vicinity. And without a substantial atmosphere to protect the surface of Ganymede, the levels of radiation on the surface would be much higher.
Okay.
Now, the combined effect of the heat shield and the atmosphere that Hyland postulated might have been a significant reduction, but we'd have to go back and run the numbers. But the bottom line is that no one really understood the effects of radiation very well at the time, just simply because we didn't have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Think of Lester Del Rey's story, Nerves. It had postulated that, written before 1940, just before, if I remember correctly, the only effect of radiation dosage was the ionization interfering with the nervous impulses.
Mm.
So that, people basically went into a type of epilepsy if they got a high radiation dose. Just from the radiation effects, if you had enough radiation for that to be an issue, you would be dead 10 to 100 times over.
Yeah.
From what we know now about radiation effects.
Yeah, science marches on.
Yeah.
I think I've always understood that that the atmosphere and the magnetic field kind of both help protect Earth, for instance, from a lot of harmful cosmic rays. Is it one more than the other?
It's the combination.
Okay.
Certainly the magnetic fields deflect a lot of the lower energy cosmic radiation away from the Earth.
Hmm.
That's more true with the North Polar region than it is near the temperate regions. But in the Van Allen belts, the radiation that gets trapped there, of course, stays there and doesn't come near the surface.
Hmm. For anybody who doesn't know about Van Allen belts, could you give a 30-second description?
Certainly. The Van Allen belts are caused by various sources of protons and electrons, solar particles, decaying neutrons from where cosmic rays interact in the atmosphere, that the particles are caught in the Earth's magnetic field, and they basically are caught in a spiral so that they travel from near the North Pole region in a wide band down to the South Band region and back. I don't know if you're going to include the graphic demonstration in your video, in your podcast or not, but
I'll see if I can find an image.
Yeah. But there are a lot of images out there. It's very well known phenomenon. So the particles are basically trapped spiraling around the magnetic field lines. And they will eventually decay because when they get to the ends and turn, they're nearer the surface of the atmosphere.
Hmm.
And as they get deeper into the atmosphere, the risk of hitting an atom in the atmosphere instead of spiraling around it, returning back into space, increases. So depending on how energetic they are and how deep they go, they will get eventually decay rather than stay in the belt.
Okay.
So that's a slow process, but during solar particle events, more protons and electrons obviously get generated into or knocked into the Van Allen belts, so the intensity increases.
Okay.
During those periods.
And then in terms of space flight from Earth, that's something that needs to be contended with?
Very much so. For short duration missions, you can just punch through. But the space station stayed in an altitude that was well below the Van Allen belts.
Okay.
And so it was not continuously in a high radiation. There's just there's one point where the proton belt comes nearer the surface of the Earth over Brazil. That's the South Magnetic Anomaly, as it's called. Mm. And the space station spends 5 to 10% of its time in there. And that would be when the people on board would receive most of the radiation dose. And also that would be the point at which the instrumentation on board would also receive most of its radiation dose and be subject to radiation effects.
Okay.
But the being protected in the atmosphere at that point, the radiation belts protect the space station from some of the worst of the cosmic rays and also from some of the worst effects of solar particle storms.
Okay. When I was reading the Mars trilogy, which is all about, terraforming, turning Mars from red into, I guess, blue ultimately. I wondered, as far as I remember, there's evidence that that Mars used to have a molten core, but now it is solidified and no longer spinning, therefore no magnetic field. Is that correct?
As I remember, and at this point I'll have to say, don't take me as an authority because it's been a while since I've seen this. There's still just a very mild fossil magnetic field around Mars.
Okay.
But it's effectively zero.
Okay. So if we put a thick Earth-like atmosphere, does that provide the protection that we would need from cosmic rays in the absence of the larger magnetic field?
If we think in the atmosphere, that would provide a substantial portion of the protection, but it wouldn't be enough, particularly during particle storms.
Okay.
You wouldn't have the magnetic effect channeling most of the effect from a particle storm from the sun into the polar regions. It would be more distributed across the entire planet.
Okay.
I know that the present level of atmosphere, people are actually able to do gamma ray spectroscopy, I think even from orbit, although mostly from the ground systems, by measuring the gamma rays that are produced from cosmic ray bombardment on the surface.
Mm.
And they're seeing enough radiation to do that.
Okay.
So the radiation fields are at the surface are fairly substantial with the present atmosphere.
I wonder if there would be anything that we could do to kind of artificially prop up the magnetic field of Mars.
There are almost certainly things that could be done. One solution, although I'm not sure that it would be a very brute force solution, would be just to dump a few nuclear bombs down to the bottom, to the core of the planet and remelt parts of it.
Mm.
Of course, you'd have to figure out a way to get them down 2,000 kilometers into the Martian surface, but that would do it. Or if you were using fission plants, just injecting the waste down to that level would probably help, although that would be a slower process.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, the Earth's core is molten because of the residual radioactive elements that were trapped when the Earth was formed, still decaying down there. I mean, the bottom line is the amount of phenomena just on Earth because of radiation is significant. I mean, the driver for lightning is largely the charge produced by cosmic radiation hitting the atmosphere.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever made that connection. That's cool.
I hadn't either until I was reading a book on lightning dynamics, and it's section 1.2. Cosmic rays are what drive this.
So, are there direct correlations between lightning activity on Earth and the solar wind or solar flares and that kind of stuff?
There have been some measurements. I mean, there are some people who believe that. One of the triggers for lightning is the ionization tracks that are caused by cosmic radiation.
Mm.
So I don't know the extent to which that's true. And I don't think it's necessarily the sole phenomenon that's happening.
In terms of its path through the atmosphere?
But in terms of the path through the atmosphere, okay. Yes. That at least the initial leaders from a lightning strike in some cases appear to follow ionization paths from cosmic rays.
Hmm. So if you get hit by lightning, you're kind of double screwed because you previously may have been hit by cosmic rays.
Well, the radiation dose would be very small in that case. But the converse of that is true. From the space station, they have measured gamma ray bursts that are caused by the heating of the atmosphere due to lightning.
Wild. Huh. I should have written down a whole bunch of speculative science questions for you, but I would have wanted to give you those in advance too. For the record, these are not questions that I'd written down and passed to Jim. They're just things that are coming to me off the top of my head. So nicely done.
Thank you.
So kind of moving off, I do want to encourage people to read if they get a copy of the Bain version of Farmer in the Sky that I had. I couldn't find it on an ebook anywhere, which at this point in my life, trade paperbacks or not trade paperbacks, mass market paperback is kind of hard on my eyes. I got to throw on my reading glasses. But yeah, if they can get a copy of this to read the essay, because it's really good stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, do you have any other kind of favorite science fiction books or movies that you would recommend?
I haven't really found any movies that I would call very hard science fiction.
Okay.
But I guess the probably some of the hardest science fiction I've I guess I tend to go more towards adventure with some science flavor rather than some of the real hard science fiction. But
sure. Yeah, and on one side of that, you have a Princess of Mars. That's the right. The adventure.
Right. But Greg Benford's novels, Barclay Examples, Timescape is the one that comes to mind first, obviously. Most of Larry Niven's work, very good hard science fiction.
Yeah.
With enough of a skin thrown to it sometimes that it
right.
may never come true. Sure. You know, that there are, the ring world is an imaginative concept, but no one would ever be able to construct a fully stable ring world without doing other modifications as well, at least.
Yeah. Well, this has given me some stuff to add to my post-podcast reading list when I have more time.
Okay.
Timescape's definitely been one that's been on my list for a while, so I'll check that out. I think I'm about out of questions, but I really appreciate you taking the time to get back to me and schedule this and everything and then have the conversation.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it as well, and it's nice to meet you. And thanks for contacting the Heinlein Society and asking them to get this together. I've been a member for several years and fully appreciate Mr. Heinlein and everything he's done, not only for science fiction directly as a field, but also for all of society through the secondary effects of his fiction and the fans of the fans who have helped improve the world in their own ways.
Yeah, I'm not sure how aware the general populace is of the Heinlein Society and the work that they do in blood drives and scholarships and all kinds of other things. Very cool.
Yes.
Do you have any online presence? I mean, the reason I had to go through the Heinlein Society is I couldn't find you anywhere.
Not really. I've stayed mostly anonymous. I did correspond regularly with Jerry Purnell while he was alive, and he was kind enough to publish several of my letters and occasionally actually ask me questions on issues of science and technology that he crossed his desk. Other than that, I've had a very, very low-key online presence. I didn't join Facebook until about a year or so ago, and that was mostly just because of family and friends.
Mm-hmm. We can honor your desire to stay more or less anonymous.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Jim, again, thank you so much for doing this. It's been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it, and thanks for getting in touch with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.